taking cold blood and take the Lord's name in veins. Of course, the same blue as pure flames. Poor skin mark with shame and war paint. Made to endure pain. Made to pour blood out until the core is drained. And now we spilling mud out drains and store rain. Dark clouds forming a crowd. Ignore claims. The crowds ignore.
What made you drop out?
Well, a lot of people think it was the 400 acid trips I took, you know.
Uh-huh, but what was it really, Bob?
One day I played CKUT in 90.3.
Then what happened?
I saw God.
You I've saw God. That. Well, that sounds like true enlightenment to me,
yeah,
Bob.
Yeah, we grim.
And on the seventh day, the Lord said,
let there be a CKUT.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
CKUT Radio.
Radio.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
Hello, dear listeners. As of March 16th, CKUT Studios will be closed until further notice. The programming on our airwaves will consist of a mixture of recent CKUT archives, new pre-recorded segments, and other relevant special programming. Our upcoming funding drive will be postponed until further notice. Thank you for understanding that we are taking these measures to protect the health of our staff and community members. Love, CKUT.
You are listening to From Embers, a weekly show on CFRC 101.9 FM about anarchist and anti-authoritarian ideas and practice. We are broadcasting from the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples on land that has come to be called Kingston, Ontario, Canada because of the thievery and brutality of the Canadian state and its empire-loving parents. From Embers is about fires, some real and some metaphorical. Fires started generations ago and tended to over the years. Little sparks all across this territory that we hope will grow, spread, and engulf the thieving state called Canada and the capitalist system that has plagued this land since the fur trade. Some of us here got a new holiday last week, Truth and Reconciliation Day, a part of the Trudeau government's push to brand itself as leaders in reconciliation with Indigenous peoples and atonement for the horrors of the residential school system. Thinking about that day, as well as the exceptionally boring federal election we all just endured, I reached out to Mike Goldhawk to chat about some broad-reaching themes to do with the state, colonialism, and reconciliation. Mike is a Métis and Cree writer and thinker based now on the West Coast, who has written about the history of policing, land back movements, as well as theoretical pieces on the meaning of land back and the significance of blockades. He's been tweeting about the federal election and Truth and Reconciliation Day, and I thought he would have an interesting perspective to share. Mike and I ended up talking about a lot of different things, some of which might be hard to hear for some listeners, so a content warning that this episode does deal directly with residential schools and the concept of forgiveness at around the middle of the interview. If you would like to hear more from Mike, you can find a lot of his writing on his website, mgoldhawk.wordpress.com. Here's my interview with Mike Goldhawk.
Well, I'm Mike Goldhawk, and I live here in Vancouver, and I've lived here most of my life. But my Métis and Cree family is from Saskatchewan, kind of the central part of Saskatchewan, in Treaty 6 territory. And Yeah, mostly I've been involved in most of my writing and I guess involvement in social movements has been based here in Vancouver.
So I sort of first had you on my radar, thought of interviewing you like just a little under a year ago, I think, when I read a piece of yours in Briar Patch called Land as a Social Relationship, where you sort of argued that the problem with settler colonialism isn't just who owns land, but rather how. I know it's a year ago and I didn't prep you to talk about that article, but can you kind of explain the thesis and what you were going for in that article?
Yeah, no problem. The main theme was that, you know, land back as a, I don't know what you would call it, a social, I guess as a social media phenomenon really was taking off. And I felt like when it started, it was like memes and it was kind of had this more, I don't know what you would call it. I kind of thought of it in terms of like graffiti or something. Like it was more of like a grassroots or like street level kind of feel to it. Even the memes, you know, it was kind of like more of a radical spirit behind the memes. It was just like literal, like literally we're not even just give us the land back, but we're already taking the land back. But then it was becoming more and more mainstream. And I noticed like a lot of discussions online, people will kind of frame it in terms of basically everything's framed in terms of the Canadian and like the capitalist and colonial framework of what property is or what land is. And they felt like the Indigenous worldview doesn't necessarily fit into that framework. But I felt like people were trying to sort of integrate land back into the Canadian colonial land and property and social system, which didn't necessarily make a lot of sense to me because there's already all kinds of bureaucratic ways within the Canadian system that they try to deal with land, you know, land claims, modern day treaties. All these things have been going on for a long time since the 70s, really. It kind of started to pick up. Whereas for me, just my personal interest has always been more in the social movements and like the grassroots people, which was also happening, you know, since the really like, for me, land back as a social movement started in the 50s with the Haudenosaunee people in what's now claimed by Quebec, Ontario, and also New York State. They started doing actions on both sides of the border, doing land reclamations, doing like actual land reoccupation camps, even back in the 50s. I don't think a lot of people are aware of that. Maybe they think it started in the late 60s, early 70s. Mm-hmm. But actually, Haudenosaunee people were doing stuff in the 50s already and occupying government offices in New York State and also kind of holding like, I don't know what you'd call it, like demos and stuff on the reserve. They're trying to stop like all these developments around water, like developments for dams and water reservoirs and things like this. And then at Six Nations of the Grand River in Ontario, they reoccupied the band council office or the band council. What would you call it? I can't remember the name of the building right now, but the council house, I think it's called, in 1958. And then in the early 60s, Coast Salish people, but down in like Puget Sound and Washington State started doing actions. For me, I always thought that like the new social media thing of like land back and like that it's just a slogan, which was like a cool slogan. It kind of started off as like a joke based on previous memes and stuff. But like a serious joke, obviously, because people obviously really want the land back and are taking it and stuff. But to me, I saw it more as like direct action, like Native people are taking action themselves to reclaim our own land and have been doing that not just since the 50s, but, you know, before that. But there was kind of a lull between, I guess, the turn of the century, between the 1800s and 1900s. And then there was kind of a lull until the 1950s when the movement started, this direct action land reclamation movement started up again. So the point of my Briar Patch thing was that people online, they just talk about property as sort of a given. They don't analyze like how or what does it mean? Like land back, is it going to be like addition to reserve? Or is it, you know, there's all these different processes that are within the Canadian government's framework. But something like what was happening with been going on for you know, decades now with the Wet'suwet'en struggle. That was people just going and doing it themselves, like as direct action. It was not through government channels when they launched it anyway, you know.
If land back doesn't or should not mean simply ownership, what does it mean? Like, what does a good relationship to land look like in that case?
Well, the way I kind of talk about it in my article too, is that even the concept of ownership is kind of not very, it's not clarified in people's mind. They think there's just one kind of property or there's one kind of ownership, and it's the Canadian colonial capitalist form of ownership, and whatever kind of concept that Indigenous people might have is just going to, has to fit into that somehow, or is somehow it's like lesser or some kind of subgenre of the Canadian system. And of course, normally like anarchists or other people would be like, oh, we're against all property and we're against this concept of ownership. But in that article, I was using an example of sort of Cree elders, and they're talking about how ownership isn't necessarily an exclusive. It's not about one person. Oh, I'm Joe property, and this is my car that I own as Joe property or whatever. It's something that can be shared, and it's not something that's just humans. It's like in the examples I used or the quotes from the Swampy Cree elders, they're saying, you know, the land doesn't just belong to Cree people. It belongs to everything that's alive and to maybe to things that aren't alive as well. Just the features of the landscape, you know, like the concept of ownership is not exclusive, and it can involve people sharing with each other. And it's also not like the colonial Canadian capitalist concept of ownership and property is based on hierarchy. Like the state is the ultimate authority, and then they will give, you know, a citizen can own private property, but that's a relationship between them as an individual and the state. And it's a hierarchical relationship. Like ultimately the state has the ultimate authority, and they can expropriate that citizen if they want. But the Cree or even other Indigenous nations, the concept of ownership, which would relate to like, usually we'd use terms like maybe Indigenous sovereignty or something, but the concept of ownership isn't, or the concept of sovereignty isn't hierarchical. There's no God, there's no king, there's no state. There's no head of state who has ultimate authority over everything and who's then going to grant us some kind of right to property. Like in contrast to that, the Indigenous or like traditional Indigenous concept would be that we all share this piece of land together. And when, you know, maybe some people have certain roles of authority in the sense that they speak or they have certain kind of information or skills, but they're not like a king or a president or something who can just order people around and have this hierarchy of like underlings who then like cops or whatever that then enforce their rule on the people. Like the difference would be that in our society, everybody has a say. And not just even a say, but everyone's involved in the organization of the community in like a non-hierarchical way. So I wanted to get into that. Like, that's too much to kind of get into in the article itself, you know, but I kind of wanted to kind of hint at those kind of things at least.
So I guess in that sense, it's not just about like who is on the land or who has title to it, but also like what they're doing with it and how they're relating to the other beings that are there. But lots of people are using that land back banner for actual movements on the ground that exist, many of which have to do either with like specific uses or with title. What can land back mean? Like if not just simply a transfer of like title to a band, what could a call for land back mean that is worthwhile in this context?
Yeah. I mean, I've always taken a lot of inspiration from the Haudenosaunee people and their struggles, and I know, I mean, directly as well from talking to people and going to their communities and seeing it. But like from their perspective, land back is them taking what already belongs to them, and it never stopped belonging to them at any point in time. And so there's nothing for the government to give back. And that's not just limited to Haudenosaunee people, but that's really for all Indigenous people, obviously. But You know, like if you take 1492 Land Back Lane or something, and before that, the land reclamation in 2006, there was never any concept. Like the concept was that the land has always already belonged to the Six Nations people. There was never any concept that there was something for the government to give to them. Like the land never belonged to the Canadian government.
Presumably though, like in that case, it's like a desire to not share that space or give it to a subdivision development in that particular case, or like a pipeline in the case of the Wet'suwet'en's most recent complaint. So clearly there is like some sense of like what uses at the very least, or who should decide what uses are going to be sharing there, right?
Yeah.
There is some kind of like specific call in both those cases, which I think you're right, is not about like land back as in just simply title. But it is about like who is making the decisions about what's going to happen on this territory right now and who should be making these decisions, if that makes sense.
Oh yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
So like in the case of say Land Back Lane, is it reasonable to call that land back when, you know, currently it seems like, well, not so much currently, a few months ago, it seemed like the state was giving permission to a developer to decide what happens with that land. And folks that are saying like, no, it should be the original people of this territory. Is that land back or is that something else?
Yeah, well, that's kind of what I was trying to get into in the whole, I mean, the whole title or the article was land is a social relationship. It's not just a physical location or an object like a car or something that you can take and then give back to somebody. My concept was that, and like you mentioned earlier, like how is the land being used? Yeah, people just want to talk about it as like a parcel, as like a distinct physical object that could be taken and then given back. But I mean, that's kind of a joke. That was like a joke in the memes to online, like in the Native community, like, oh, here's like a bag of dirt. Like you, like land back is like literally like, would be like a white person like scooping up a bag of dirt and then like delivering it to a Native person or something, you know, just kind of like making fun of that concept, you know, because it's more about the social relations. And then like you're saying, like, how is the land being used? And the Canadian government says, oh yeah, you know, this settler corporation can build a housing development without asking the traditional people of Six Nations how they want to do it. And then in my article, I was trying to take it even further than that, because I was talking about like the Métis women's community or committee, sorry, in Saskatchewan, where they were trying to stop this Adopt Indian and Métis program. You know, so they were saying like, looking at like all our social relations, like land back won't just be like just us taking one parcel of land. It'll involve all our different social relations, you know, and not just our families, but yeah, the way that we interact with the land and maybe not just, yeah, the land is kind of an abstract concept the way people use it sometimes, but more like our location. Like it could be the city as well, right? Like the Métis committee, maybe they're in Saskatoon, maybe they're Prince Albert, maybe they're in Regina, but those are all, that's all Native land. That's all Cree and Métis and other nations land as well. So I was trying to, I guess, take it to, in some ways, a more abstract level where I was saying like land back could involve, rather than these kind of things of like directing it towards the government or something, or trying to get the government or corporations to do something for us, I was more trying to direct it towards us stopping what the government and these corporations are doing and us sort of like rebuilding our sort of healthy social relations with each other, or things that we used to have, like rebuilding our communities in the sense of like a social community, not just a physical location.
Who is the us that you're speaking of in particular when you talk about that?
Yeah, well, I guess all my writing is actually more directed at Native people, but it's cool if it, obviously a lot of, I guess the audience is non-Native, which is totally cool with me as well, you know, but actually it actually becomes a thing because my writing is more, yeah, more directed at Native people. But then a lot of times, you know, people will ask me to make it a little bit more understandable or more of like for a general audience or something. And I guess in the past, other things I wrote was more just for a general audience. But then now I've sort of leaning more into writing things directly for Native people, but it depends on the article too. But obviously something like land back, like a land back article, it's probably going to be more directed at Native people. Yeah.
You're tracing the origins of what some might call a land back movement to the 1950s, it does feel like something has grown in recent years, whether it's that more things are happening or that more settlers are paying attention or what, I think is a bit unclear. Why do you think that's happening? What do you think is going on there? Like, why are there like so many people calling for land back, including, I think, like, white people who are literally trying to like do the thing that you're joking about, like give title, but also including movements, broad-based movements to actually like, you know, support autonomy and self-determination on various territories across so-called Canada. Like why does it feel like there's more of that, or there's more attention on that in the last few years, do you think?
I would say that it's kind of been building since the so-called Oka crisis. I would guess, because there was a lot of non-native, I mean, obviously that was mostly about Native solidarity across Canada, but there was a lot of non-Native solidarity as well. And before that, I would say like in the 80s with Indigenous movements, a lot of the non-Native support was more like, there was a big environmentalist movement and things like that, non-Native environmentalist movement, but it didn't really, they're more just trying to kind of do their own thing and then sort of like latch on to Native struggles in sort of an NGO type way. Mm-hmm. And that still exists today, but I felt like the Oka crisis probably changed that a little bit, because it wasn't the same kind of struggle. It wasn't really quite as palatable maybe to NGO groups. But a lot of non-Native people supported it. And then I feel like things have been growing since then, as far as Indigenous resistance has been growing, like in 95 with Ipperwash and Gustafson Lake, and then Mi'kmaq struggle in the late 90s, early 2000s. And then things have been escalating like all over across Canada since then. But then particularly, I guess, the Wet'suwet'en struggle, like they did a lot of outreach to everyone, Native and non-Native, and they've been there for so long, and a lot of people passed through. You know, obviously, like the Canadian state kind of realized that the healing center and camp there was becoming this sort of ideological, you know, in their words, they're like, this is like an ideological focal point for Indigenous resistance across the country. And so I think when things escalated there, there was already like non-Native people wanting to support that and supporting it in some ways, but yeah, just escalated it. I'm not really sure exactly why there was like so much more like kind of overt or obvious Native, non-Native support for that struggle in, I guess, I'm losing track of time now because of COVID. It was like 2020, 2021.
Yeah. Most recent wave, winter 2020. Yeah.
Yeah, but there was a raid the year before that, yes, too. Like this last year was when there was all the blockades and stuff. But then the year before that, there was a raid of the Gidimten, mm-hmm, checkpoint. And there was some solidarity at that time too, but it wasn't like all these crazy blockades and stuff. But I feel like that kind of built up, like everything was kind of escalating progressively until last year's, the cross-country, mm-hmm, blockades. So I can only imagine, I don't know what's going on in Victoria. There seems like there's a lot of non-Native support, people organizing there.
I interviewed Skylar Williams, spokesperson of Land Back Lane, a couple months ago. And he seemed pretty struck also by how much more support that particular land reclamation has had this year from outside of the community compared to 2006 as well. And yeah, it does feel a little bit like there's kind of a moment, right? Like there's like a lot of people out there who seem like they want to show up and support this stuff for a variety of reasons. He definitely was on the side of like, that's just a good thing. It's just helping us. What do you think about that? Do you think that it's positive? Are there pitfalls?
Yeah, I think it's mostly positive. I mean, maybe it's related to Native people just kind of have a higher profile in the general like Canadian culture now than they did like 10, 15, 20 years ago. You know, like there's a lot of like Native literature and things like, mm-hmm, this that non-Native people are reading now. So maybe there's just like, and in other forms of media too, like maybe just the general like media culture, non-Native people are more aware, and there's all these things building on each other, like Idle No More and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and all these things. Like it's more in the public awareness than it used to be. So maybe that all plays into it. I think it's mostly positive, the non-Native involvement. And also, like, I had this article in the called Building Blocks in this Midnight Sun magazine online, and I was talking about how part of the difference this time is that, say, during the Oka Crisis 1990, non-Native people were just doing like protests or marches, or they would set up like a peace, they'd call it like a peace camp or something like that. Actually, maybe those are set up by like Native people, but then non-Native people would just join them or whatever. But then I was saying that the difference this time, or this last time last year with all the blockades, was that non-Native people were also doing blockades or doing different kinds of actions like that, or like civil disobedience actions, or, you know, they surrounded the legislature building in Victoria and kind of tried to prevent the provincial government from meeting and stuff like that. So it was like on a larger scale, but also different kinds of actions. I guess a mix of kind of like civil disobedience stuff, but then also people doing more like direct action blockades and things like that. So I think that's good, but I think there can also be pitfalls too, because there are still these like NGO groups and things like that that are getting involved. So it kind of depends on what they're doing or how they're trying to be in support of Native people. And obviously there's lots of different kinds of groups, like non-Native groups, and everyone has their own different motivations and things like this. And everyone has their own different level of like awareness or how much they want to sort of like follow Native people's lead, or even what that means, or they don't is arbitrarily, I mean, it's kind of problematic because they just have to arbitrarily pick like a certain Native person to follow. And it's not necessarily going to be, it doesn't necessarily match like a politics or a thing that's good to do. If that makes any sense. I don't know. That's kind of like opening a can of worms there, but
it's a can of worms that we open pretty regularly. I think like how and when should settlers choose? Should it be based on politics? Should it be based on identity? I think we've talked about that a bunch on the show, and we're always open to talking about that for sure. I mean, there's also Justin Trudeau, right? There's also like this guy leading the country with like his Haida tattoo, and he seems to be able to conjure some tears for survivors. And I think in many ways he kind of employs like a lot of the discourse of like liberal guilt or shame about colonialism that in some senses is also fueling those movements. And he takes that language and uses it to be the Prime Minister of Canada, who of course is like inflicting a lot of that harm. What do we make of that? Like, what is his role in that? And what kind of strategy is he using there?
Yeah, definitely say it's a strategy for colonialism. Yeah. But it's a different, like, you're right. Yeah. It's a different strategy than what his dad's strategy was, which was just like a you know, watch what I'm going to do to you kind of strategy. So his son Justin has a more sophisticated strategy, really. Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point. You know, it's playing into this general sort of thing of white guilt and all this, and it's really problematic. And I mean, it's almost kind of connected to like the movement for Black Lives too, because there was like this whole sort of guilt industry built up around that, right? With like white authors, like put out a book like White Fragility or something like this. So it's become like, and there's similar things for Native people too, where it's like, yeah, it's becoming this sort of like capitalist packaging of white guilt that's then sort of like sold to people and like turned into an industry in itself. And then I wrote an article about how UNDRIP was being turned into an actual capitalist industry here in BC, basically, because the government's like patting themselves on the back. Oh, we adopted UNDRIP and it's all about Indigenous rights and all this, but it's actually being promoted by corporations who are like, this is good for business. Like, we're going to increase mining. We're going to build more pipelines. You know, there's directly where people involved in promoting the pipelines against Unistaten and Gidimton and stuff. They were at this meeting for UNDRIP, promoting UNDRIP, you know? So yeah, it's definitely, there's this whole academic and as well as government industry around reconciliation and turning it into a way to make money off of ongoing colonialism, but packaging it as if it's something progressive.
You are listening to From Embers on CFRC 101.9 FM, or you might be listening to the podcast edition of From Embers on your smartphone or another device.
We are currently sharing my interview with Mike Goldhawk about reconciliation, the state, and land back. Just a content warning, a heads up that in the next part of the interview, we do directly discuss the residential school system and its impact on survivors. I mean, let's talk about reconciliation a bit. I think that is a word that, like, prior to Trudeau's tenure, even some movements were using on the ground. And now I think it's very clearly something that the government is pushing primarily. What does that word mean? Could it be a good thing? Like, what do we make of that particular term?
Yeah, to me, it's a bit of a nonsensical term in itself. Yeah, I mean, it's totally nonsensical term in itself to me. And I take, Maria Campbell, she's obviously a Métis writer and organizer for a lot of decades, but she, I don't know if she was the first to point it out, but she was explicitly like, it doesn't make sense because to reconcile a relationship, you would have had to have already had a good relationship in the first place. And then the relationship would go bad and then you'd reconcile it. But that has nothing to do with the history of Canada as it actually played out in reality and in history. It never had a good relationship. And particularly, I'd say, with the Métis, it's always been a warfare relationship where the state has always been at war with us. And it's only now that all these official Métis groups are, or maybe since, you know, the 70s or 80s or something, start being able to collaborate with the state. But it's always been, you know, them sending the army in 1870 and then 1885 and the police. The RCMP is basically designed specifically for us and for other Cree and other Indigenous nations on the prairies, like specifically designed to undermine our sovereignty or our ability to not be colonized or under their government, you know. But then on the other hand, I can see how for people who survived residential schools, people, obviously a lot of people are still alive today who attended residential schools, and a lot of people's parents did, you know, people I've met and friends of mine, and for a long time, nobody knew, or like in the Canadian public, like it wasn't a lot of awareness about residential schools. So it's like really important for people to have some kind of like acknowledgement of that, or something like public, where like not just something public, like, but it was like super important for the government of Canada, not just people or Canadians or something, but it was like super important to have like the actual state acknowledge that they had done this thing, which is a crime, which is genocide. You know, they won't use those terms, but they're acknowledging the thing itself, that they had this residential school system, and they're acknowledging it was wrong in some level. You know, they're not really accurately saying what it was, and they're also putting it in the past. By doing that is the other problem with it. They're saying, you know, oh, there was this institution and it was removed, but so that's it. Now we can start this process of truth and reconciliation where we're moving on to something else, right? That's part of the problematic aspect of it, is that, of course, it's good that, I mean, it can't even really put it into words. Good isn't the word for it, but of course, the residential school system needed to be abolished, or I would say destroyed. You know, a lot of Native people, they didn't abolish the residential schools. They literally destroyed them themselves. Even when they were children, they would organize to destroy the schools, which is good, it's not even just good. It just makes sense. If people are trying to destroy you through some institution, you destroy that institution. Just like prisoners today will riot or whatever and try to destroy the prison that they're in. It's the same. It's not exactly the same thing, but it's along similar lines, right? Like for me, the residential schools and all these things are part of like an overall carceral system, a system of incarceration and prisons and the child welfare. six, you know, ongoing 60 scoop, millennium scoop, all these things are all part of this overall incarceration thing, even the reserve system and the Indian Act and all these things. So for me, reconciliation and these like apologies and acknowledgement and all these things are kind of it's kind of a double-edged sword. Yeah. And even a lot of people, like, I will say that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission process was traumatizing for them. On the one hand, they really needed this process. They needed this like public acknowledgement. But then a lot of the people who went, they said, you know, this was like re-traumatizing for them. And the way it was carried out was re-traumatizing. And not just re-traumatizing for them, but it's re-traumatizing for their children and all of their relatives as well. For a lot of different reasons, you know, but partly how it's done too, you know, it's all a Government of Canada run thing ultimately. And ultimately they're not actually trying to get rid of colonialism, you know? So, I
don't know. Of course it's not nothing. The language of it actually, I think, like, primarily evokes like South Africa, right? Like they're calling it like a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Yeah. They're acknowledging in words that there are like really substantial harms that something should be done about in a way that I think previous governments have not done. It holds meaning to state those things in public. I think that's like, that's important to acknowledge for sure. I wonder what will come of it. Like, I wonder how substantial a shift it really represents for the state to declare a day like that. And like, what could possibly come of that moving forward? Yeah, I think it's unclear, but maybe you have thoughts about that, about like what will or won't change as a result of that shift in framing, that shift in like rhetoric, from outright denial to something slightly different that maybe it's hard to name.
Yeah, I thought for me, like for my part, I'm not, my family and myself are not as like directly affected by residential schools as a lot of people I know who, like I said, went themselves or their parents went. So I try to sort of, I'd say I try to like temper the way I talk about it a bit. Like it did affect my family, but it's a bit more distant. But for my part, I still obviously have opinions about it all. And like I found this National Day to be really trivializing of the experience, because I would just saw it's just it doesn't make any sense to me for people to have a vacation or a holiday to acknowledge this thing. Like it's always been Orange Shirt Day. And, you know, there's before, and I guess still maybe they just moved it to a different day because the kids weren't necessarily in school on that day, but usually like kids would be in school and they'd be doing educational things to learn about residential schools and to learn about Orange Shirt Day, you know, all as part of Orange Shirt Day. But then on this day, you know, all the kids are out of school and they're out getting like ice cream and stuff and adults and people are going out shopping and enjoying this day off. To be honest, I found it really disgusting to have non-Native people. To me, it was like a celebration of genocide. And I'm sure they didn't look at it that way. But it's just weird to have it on that day where it's supposed to be about, ultimately, the reconciliation thing is supposed to be about residential schools and genocide and doing something to... Is people are supposed to move on? I don't know. I never understood that. I never understood how you could forgive genocide, you know? It's not like someone just stole someone took your guitar or something, or someone crashed your car or something like that, you know? It's not like something that you can forgive anyone for, to me. I don't know. Maybe you're supposed to or something. I don't know. I know it's like, yeah, it's an odd thing because I understand like the apology is important, really important. It's crucial to a lot of people, but yeah, I don't know. Like in our culture, like to me, part of it all plays into Christianity in a way, like the whole turn the other cheek and forgive people and stuff. Like, I don't know. To me, that seems really Christian and European. And to me, I don't really know like my own culture that well, but my understanding is that we, if there was like a serious problem in the community and people are really harming each other, like certain things you forgive or whatever, or maybe even really horrible things you can forgive people eventually. But the main thing was to stop the actual harm from being carried out. You're not just going to tolerate, like if someone's going around, they're stealing from people or, you know, hurt, causing physical harm to people or things like this. It wasn't just tolerated and be like, oh, let's move on now. They said, sorry, let's move on now. But they get to keep on doing this negative thing that's harming the community. You know, doesn't make any sense.
Can you speak a bit to what those things are? Like what would need to actually happen to have, like, to begin a conversation about reconciliation moving forward? Like, what are the things that are missing from that? What needs to be done still before we can start talking about that kind of stuff?
Well, I think the general problem is like relying on the state to do something, and framing everything in terms of the state is the main problem. Like, instead of, like, the way Maria Campbell was talking about it was reconciliation doesn't really make sense, right? Because we never had a good relationship. But putting that aside for the moment, you could have the concept, right, that you would create a new relationship that was good, that was like different than what happened before. That wouldn't be reconciliation. That would be something else, right? But we can have that concept that for Native people, that we would create a new relationship with the non-Native people, like the non-Native population of this continent and this country. But to me, it'll never involve the state. Like, to me, the state is inherently, I mean, the state in itself is inherently problematic, but the settler colonial state in particular, I don't think there's any way they can ever reconcile themselves with Native people. Like, from their perspective, and even in like the Supreme Court of Canada decisions, they'll frame reconciliation as Native people's rights have to be reconciled with Canada, which is like not really how I think the general public thinks of reconciliation. They would think of it as like two equal sides coming together, even though that's not really, you know, super accurate or whatever, but they have this sort of like positive mentality about it. Like, reconcile, it's not about one person superior to the other and then you come to an agreement or something. But from the perspective of Canada and the Supreme Court and, yeah, the state, their perspective is that they stole the land fair and square, and now Native people have to reconcile themselves with the fact that their land belongs to Canada now. Like, if we get beyond all the bullshit of like the nice words and stuff, like, that's how Canada and the Supreme Court look at it, is that like, reconcile wouldn't be the right word for it. It'd be like resignation. Like, they want Native people to resign themselves to the fact that the colonizers are here to stay, and they stole the land fair and square, and it belongs to them now, and it will for all time. But obviously Native people don't. So a lot of Native people have the opposite perspective, that it's always been Native land and it always will be. And that's like a popular slogan in Australia with Indigenous people too, right? Like, it'll always be Indigenous land. And I think that's important too, to recognize like settler colonialism is not, like, that's a problem with this National Day of Reconciliation for Canada, but settler colonialism is an international system. It's not a national system of just Canada. It's a system where every country in the world says that Canada, the United States, New Zealand, and Australia are legitimate countries, that they stole the land fair and square, and now it's theirs. And whatever rights Native people have in any of those countries are subordinate. They're subordinate. The whole concept of rights is based on subordination, that there's somebody lower, which would be, in another case, would be Native people. And then the state above us grants us our rights or recognizes our rights. But obviously that goes totally against the Native concept, where we just inherently, I don't know what you want to call it. Maybe we wouldn't use the word rights, maybe say like freedoms or relationships. We have the responsibilities. A lot of times we would use the concept of, we're responsible to the land, we're responsible to other animals, or responsible to each other, or responsible to other groups of people, other Native peoples and other groups of people. And we want to be in like healthy relationships with everybody. It's not so much the concept of rights, this higher, it's like a, that's, which is like a hierarchical relationship where some superior entity who's saying they have all the rights to everything, and then they'll give you like a sub right underneath them. You get to be like a, what do you call it? Like a wholly owned subsidiary, like a corporate, like there's an umbrella corporation and there's small corporations underneath them who have rights, but it's all ultimately granted through this hierarchical system or whatever. Sorry to ramble on again.
It's not rambling. I think it's actually a really important point. It's like you're talking about this whole reconciliation thing, but if you're not willing to put Canada into question, it doesn't really make any sense. Like that's like one of the central elements of that harm is like the creation of that state that you're not saying reconciliation can happen with.
So there was just this like whole election, sort of. I mean, doesn't seem like anything changed. I don't vote, but I also don't think that all government policies are just like exactly the same as each other when you're living under them. Was there anything in this election for you or anyone you know? Like, does it matter at all?
Well, I've never voted that I've known of. I might have when I was like when I first turned of age, I guess, like 18 or something. I didn't really know. I don't think I even voted then, but I think my parents were trying to get me to vote just because I'd turned of age or something. I don't think I even actually went through with it. But in this one, I didn't really pay too much. Like sometimes I pay a bit of attention to like the platforms or what the parties are arguing and stuff just for the sake of it, just to know what's going on, like know your enemy kind of thing, even though I don't vote myself and I don't believe in it and I don't believe in that system. And also it's like a foreign system, you know, if we believe in native sovereignty, it's kind of weird to the concept of voting for like a foreign government, you know, like I don't vote in like British elections either, you know, or I don't vote in the elections of Germany or something. And to me, Canada is the same thing. It's a foreign country. Just because it's here on this continent doesn't mean that it's not a foreign country.
But like as an adversary, is there a difference between Justin Trudeau in his jean jacket with his, you know, his tears and Harper or O'Toole or someone who's going to be a little bit more hard-nosed about it and like admit that there are invasions happening perhaps? Like, does that matter? Does it change anything for people?
Yeah, that's a different, yeah, those are two different things. And I definitely agree with you that it's not like there's no difference between the parties and it's not like different policies don't matter. I think that is totally the case, but I see that as being pretty separate from like the election process. I see those as being kind of two different things because our ability as individuals to like affect who gets in is basically non-existent. I mean, it is non-existent.
What are some examples of land back struggles out there that do inspire you? And in what particular ways are they taking on the Canadian state? Like, what is their strategy for fighting the Canadian state right now?
I guess one of the, like, there's two main strategies. One would be to just physically reoccupy land, which a lot of times that's happening. It's not necessarily public. Like, I guess it's hard to divide that. It's hard to divide, like the physical reoccupation of land with the use of that land, which is kind of what you brought up and what we were talking about earlier, right? Because aside from these sort of like big public things like 1492 Land Back Lane, like those are super important and great, obviously. But like here in BC, a lot of communities are just going out and fishing or doing like traditional gathering practices. They don't necessarily make a big public thing about it. It's not like a big public action or something like that. But then there become similar things like in the 60s down the coast in Puget Sound, the Coast Salish people there, you know, Nisqually and Puyallup bands and stuff, they would be, they just started fishing. And like that was their direct action because the government wasn't following the treaties, right? And then nowadays, it's a very similar thing with the Mi'kmaq or Mi'kmaq people on the east coast of Canada, where they have the treaty right to fish and they just go out and do it. They don't necessarily, you know, sometimes it's through done like in accordance with government regulations or there's some dialogue with the Canadian government or provincial governments or whatever. But ultimately, the concept is that like on the east coast, those peace and friendship treaties, they predate Canada by a long time. And there's nothing in those treaties that says that colonial governments have any right to tell Indigenous people what to do. It says the opposite. It says that Mi'kmaq people can, they still, it basically says, you know, maybe not in exact words, but it's basically guaranteeing Mi'kmaq sovereignty, that Mi'kmaq people can can fish according to their own law. That's the whole concept of a treaty, is that there's two separate groups of people that have, that kind of retain their freedom to do what they were doing before. It's not, but then the Canadian government's concept of a treaty is that it's like this this hierarchical dominating thing where there's a lesser, there's a greater and a lesser party, and Canada is the greater party and Native people are the lesser party, which is like not what it's supposed to be. But yeah, I find the Mi'kmaq, the fishing struggle inspiring. And I find like there's still ongoing struggles up north here in BC with the Gidimt'en checkpoint. They're just, some people are getting arrested and they're trying to stop more destruction of their land there. And that's inspiring. Yeah. They're really, fierce people. And the Gik'san struggle was inspiring last year. Like when Tiendanega got raided, the Gik'san community went down and blocked the railways, like in a large group. And, you know, the cops arrested their hereditary chiefs. And then tons more people came down and blocked the highway and blocked it until the RCMP let the hereditary chiefs go. So that was pretty inspiring. And then now I know they're doing more actions in Gik'san territory too. They're doing some kind of like land reoccupation actions up there too. So yeah, I don't know how much it's relevant to this conversation, but yeah, just a lot of times things will start with direct action and then they'll get to like sort of a more negotiation point or whatever. but then things just have to go back to direct action again. So I'm not sure. Like our people, I guess, have a lot of trust or faith that we're always trying to like do the right thing and sort of like give Canada a chance to do the right thing. But then the problem is that Canada, it's all just superficial, and then they just go back to stealing the land again. So, and then we just have to go back to doing direct action again. So it's like a vicious cycle.
I think that like the fishery case, the example that you brought up with the Mi'kmaq, is a really interesting example of what you were talking about at the beginning of this conversation about like ownership or title versus use. Of course, one of the solutions to that conflict has been to sell Clearwater, one of the largest fishery companies operating out there, to a Mi'kmaq corporation. The state has claimed that they are transferring Clearwater to the Mi'kmaq for the purpose of like, you know, the massive large scale deep sea fishing, which is not like, that's not the action that was taken by the same people who are out there fighting for like their own fishery. But I think it is like a really interesting case where it's like, the attempt clearly is to solve it simply by like transferring title or ownership of a thing, when in many ways what people have been talking about all along is about like how to use land or ocean, I guess, in this case, not simply who, right? Which I thought was kind of an interesting kind of like circle back or whatever to what you were sort of talking about at the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, like that particular thing is, I mean, all these things are a little bit complex, but you know, there's all this complexity with like band councils doing stuff versus grassroots people and all this, and it's different in each nation and every location. But I would say the thing you're talking about with them selling off that thing, that seemed like, whoa, that's this crazy new thing. Nobody's heard of this before. Like they're selling the Mi'kmaq bands are buying this company or something. But actually I'd say that's just sort of actually building off of all these things that have happened before with like the treaty process out here in BC, or the so-called modern treaties. And all these different, all these corporations, there's this whole industry now of, there's like an industry of people who will consult a corporation on how to sit down and consult with Native people, right? And like how to get this, how to get a corporate project developed, how to get a Native community to consent to it, or how to get them even directly involved in it. And there was similar stuff like with Bands on the Prairies, where they wanted to buy the Trans Mountain, or you know, buy into the Trans Mountain pipeline, which, you know, obviously bands and communities out here in BC, some of them don't want, which is a problematic thing in itself, right? Like how can one band say development is okay on another band or another nation's territory? Doesn't really make sense to me. But there was even like here in BC, there's the Métis groups saying okay to the Trans Mountain pipeline, but it's not their territory. They don't have any right to say okay to it or get any money from it, you know. So
even if it was their territory, right, like something like a pipeline obviously has impacts beyond like a border defined parcel of land anyway. Yeah, I think it's pretty difficult to talk about things like that, even in terms of just like ownership. I wanted to ask you, you have a new article out, coming out in like a Little Black Cart anthology that's about anti-politics. Can you explain what that means to you? Like what's anti-politics? That's an intriguing term.
Well, it was a thing, actually. It has been a thing for a long time in California. The anarchist scene down there, they used to have like a website and a forum and stuff called Anti-Politics. And that's Aragorn was involved in that.
I guess I meant more like, what does it mean to you?
I mean, that's what they were. that's what the whole thing was. That's basically all they gave me. Like when they asked me to write something for the book, they're just like, it's anti-politics, like indigenous anti-politics. And they didn't really give me any more like guidance on it. So I, from my perspective, I'm like, what am I going to do? Usually I don't write things that are that personal or usually I like pick like a subject or like a struggle or something that's going on or like a book review or something really specific. But that was so general, like anti-politics. Like so my only way, the only way I could think of it was to talk about what it personally, what does it personally mean to me? What does anti-politics personally mean to me? So my article was kind of like a personal thing of different, I guess, starting with different like historical indigenous struggles against like the police and stuff. Like I mentioned the 1492 Land Back Lane, but also the in 1885, where my family's from in Saskatchewan, there was a war between the Métis and Cree people and the Canadian government. So I'm kind of mentioning these things of trying to like this continuity of like struggle against the police and against the Canadian state. And then I kind of go into like different struggles that are going on now, like the Mi'kmaq and Wet'suwet'en struggle. And then I kind of talk about like my own sort of like a little bit of my own sort of personal, I guess, experience with like the indigenous resistance movement and stuff. So I was talking about like when I was a young teenager or whatever, there was still some like court support going on for Gustafson Lake, Shwatmuk supporters and stuff in like the late '90s, early 2000s. And so that was sort of my introduction to the whole world of indigenous resistance, because before that I was young and I was just like, mostly living with like non-native family and stuff like that. So that struggle kind of like opened my mind. And then the Native youth movement, things they were doing after that, I kind of talked about that. But then later in the article, I go into like, there's a story that my own ancestor wrote, one of my great grandparents, who was Swampy Cree. He wrote a story that was, he wrote it in the late 1800s, and then it didn't get published until the 1970s. By like anthropologists and academics and stuff, or like check out this Swampy Cree story. And but the story itself, I was like, wow, it was really incredible for me to read, because it's a very like anti-authoritarian, anti-hierarchical story, which was written in the late 1800s. But actually, the writer James Seti is talking about how it's basically him retelling a story that he heard when he was a child, when he went back to, his home community, he was visiting his home community up north in what's now northern Manitoba, like right near the Hudson's Bay. And so it's like him retelling the story that an elder in the community told. And then for me, like the content of the story is kind of anti-political, but also the way that it was told, like the actual manner or like how it was told was anti-political, because you have people retelling stories and retelling each other's stories. But even at the end of it, he's like, oh, the whole community, they started clapping. They liked the story. And then they sort of had like a discussion after. They're like, what does this mean? Like, what is the sort of principles of the story, or what is it trying to get across? And people kind of talk about it. And so to me, like the content and the structure was kind of anti-political. And like, the content of the story, it's about this like conflict between brothers, older and younger brothers. And then the younger brother, he has a sort of anti-political, anti-authoritarian kind of mentality that he talks about in the story. And so in a way, it's kind of like, this underdog story of like overcoming a more powerful adversary. So I don't know. I was just amazed when I read that, because it kind of...
Sarah's excited to celebrate her birthday at a restaurant. She's thought about it all week. She invited her friends. She got a new dress. She went to the restaurant. She wasn't allowed in the restaurant. She had to put away her new dress. She couldn't see her friends. And she thought about it all week.
Don't wait until it hits you. Get vaccinated. A vaccination passport is now required to enter certain public spaces. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
90.3 FM is proud to rebroadcast the following program entirely in the Mohawk language. The Mohawk, or Ganyatgahaga, are the original people of the unceded traditional territory known as Montreal, or Chojaake. The Ganyatgahaga, or people of the Flint, have two communities close by, and they are working hard at revitalizing their language. This program is part of those efforts, and it originally aired in Ganasadage on RKR Reviving Ganasadage Radio. And now, listen to Chojaake's indigenous language on CKUT.
FM.